So I'd like to welcome you all. Thank you. As my day's number in giving talks here, I find that there's a preciousness to the procedure, to the process that I might have taken for granted before. And I just want to sort of affirm the relationships that have been so long-standing and your dedication to the practice. It's beautiful to see. I want to just mention out of context, the talk tonight is really on moving from noise to stillness. And that's the reason I read the poem, "We Make Too Much Noise." Before I do so, because I've been reading a lot about sort of how contemporary Buddhism in particular, but spirituality in general, people are arguing about whether we should be more outgoing, outward, in terms of social engagement and social interaction, uplifting the whole culture as we engage within it, or whether we should be more inward and more introspective in sort of understanding what the issues are internally. And I think that this it's an interesting question, and I think it's uniquely this age's question. Hasn't really been a question that I am aware of in the past, especially in Buddhism, because mainly Buddhism up until this era has been a monastic tradition, mostly monastic, and therefore very inward. But I think because we're a very engaged group of citizenry, and we're also lay, that there's a nice blend now that's happening between those two, the inward and the outward. But I think we should understand the limitations of moving too quickly into an outward engagement, especially prior to understanding the difficulties and problems that are being addressed outwardly, but also where they're coming from inwardly, because the inward confusion can certainly add to the antagonism and conflict of the outward situation. Now, I don't think, if I look at the earth sort of historically, I think we are, the earth in general, is becoming more conscious. I think it's maybe hard to see, because when something becomes more conscious, the shadow that it threatens also rises in equal persuasion. And so you have the politics of the era, but you also have the terrorism of the era. But in addition, you have the consciousness of people who aren't making the daily news, but are in the backgrounds as well. And so I do believe that there's an evolutionary process to consciousness as an entire earth, and I think that that is growing towards awakening, and it holds a lot of potential, I think, for the future. Whether it will meet the crises that are current, I don't know. But I do think that is happening, and I think that none of us fully can awaken until all beings awaken. I think that when you begin to understand that we're not about differentiations, but we're about the unification and connectedness of life, then you begin to realize that you can't and should not and cannot leave the poorest of the poor behind. Everyone has to move in this direction, or all of us are limited in some way. But that does not mean in any way that we have to forget the inward process. I think currently I hear people arguing for one or the other versus the other. And I don't think that's the right way to think about it. We are pulled in one direction or the other very naturally. I was pulled for a number of years in a very inward direction, became a monk, stayed at lay and monastic centers for many years. And then no one had to tell me, I just naturally felt that that phase of my practice was over and started engaging in and working with the dying for a number of years. And so there's a natural flow inward and outward like the tides, and it shouldn't be pitted against one another that you're doing something wrong if you're in this camp or this camp arguing for the other. That's the divisiveness of the conflicts in general. That's a derivation of it all. So let's not add our voice to that kind of contentiousness and just move in alignment and resonant with our own spirit, with our own needs. Not to forget, though, that the inward understanding, the inward disposition of yourself, of who you are, of how, what you know yourself to be, will determine the course of all interactions, all exchanges going forward. And the deeper that understanding, the less conflict we will create within those interactions. Now I want to talk about from noise to stillness. Because I think we lose the focus of what a spiritual journey is. The problem that the spiritual journey is attempting to resolve is that we have conceived life separate from us. Now that's the problem. That's it. So it's not that we don't have enough love or that we're missing some essential ingredient in ourselves. And much of our practice really has to do with further separating ourselves because of our focused sense of self-focus that we think we are somehow deprived of certain components or qualities that are essential for my ability to move forward. And I think that's the wrong way to look at the spiritual journey. In fact, if you enter the spiritual journey from that direction, there's a vast difference between that and resolving the real issue, which is conceptual separation. Now you say, well, things are separate, aren't they? From the way we see, from our perceptions, they seem separate. Now, why would that be? Well, because we had to survive as a species, as an individual. We needed to see things separately so that we could, as a species, be able to handle the traumas, the hardships, the beasts of prey that were all around us as we were evolving. And we needed to come up with some way to be able to meet the problems of those times. And we did that through our conceptual thought. If I can see the lion, and I can see a stick on the ground, and I know that stick could be a useful weapon against that lion, that all of a sudden doesn't make me the beast of prey, it makes me the preyer of the beast. And so we flip the whole thing around through our ability to think abstractly. And that is a tremendous advantage going forward. And so most of us built into our genetic code is the conceptualization of life, the wording of life. We're wordsmiths. And so we have carried that with us, and as children have been born, are born, they have to also go through that ontological process of separating themselves as an individual before they can then see the crisis of being an individual and hopefully reemerge back into the union that life is. And so it's not to deny an individual their growth of being an individual at all, but it's not to arrest that growth at just the individual's level. Because each of us have within inside of us a deep sensing that life is more connected than we believe it to be. We sense it. And we get driven by it. And you do meditation retreats because of it. Now that should be a link, that should be a honing link for the direction of our path. What is this sense of me perceiving life outside of myself? Why is that happening? You see, that's a very different question than the question of what's wrong with me. Why do I need to fix something wrong with me? When we split ourselves out, if you take the whole and divide it by two, would it surprise you to think that the halves would feel deficient? Well, that's our deficiency, is because we know we are more than what we have taken ourselves to be. And just because we have divided ourselves away from the whole doesn't mean there isn't, that we aren't intrinsically a part of that whole. And that's why the longing maintains and sustains itself. That's why we sense life could be very different than the front pages of the newspaper. We just believe that separation, there's something wrong there, even though our eyes keep confirming that fact. Why do the eyes confirm it? Okay, there is the genetic reason why our eyes confirm it, but there's also the ongoing investment that we give into the noise we create in life. If I can wordsmith life, if I can abstract life, suddenly the word that I give to an object or a person is more important than the actual experience I have of them or it. Because the word carries my recognition of that person and the history I've had with that person, and the experience doesn't. The raw experience of someone free of the recognition is a very new interaction. In fact, I was watching something in PBS where somebody had a part of their brain that is the recognizing, the part of them that sees and recognizes what they see severed somehow in an accident. And so every moment was completely new to this person. Someone would come in, perhaps his wife of 40 or 50 years would come in, and he would greet her as if he had never met her. He would turn around to get a glass of water, he'd turn back to the woman, and again they would have to renew their introduction moment after moment. Okay, so none of us want to be like that, do we? I wouldn't call that freedom, would you? No, okay, let me answer that for you. That's not where we're going in this. But when you just hold the person to be what you have known them to be, so that there's nothing new about the person or the object, then everything gets very staid, very settled in position. And there's no fluidity, there's no mystery. There's nothing profound that could happen because everything is absolutely known and in place. Like you buy a new car, and you expect that new car to be unblemished, and then a tree falls on you. How do you handle that new situation at midnight? Though we want to have a sense of newness and mystery in life, and at the same time be able to recognize our friends and our partners and be able to navigate the world. Are those two in conflict? Well, the recognition factor, the knowledge, does carry a sense of differentiation. I know something about this. And so the mirror object of a reflected, the mirror subject of a reflected object is a sense of I. If you're going to know something, there's going to be an I that knows it. So if you're going to carry the recognition and the knowledge along with you, you can be assured that you're going to have a sense of I separate from the thing you're noticing or recognizing. Okay? So you aren't going to get over that, right? You can realize that it's a mechanical quality of mind, that it's necessary to be in the world. You have to know that you're different from the door to pass your way through the door. That's not the egoic differentiation that I'm talking about. The egoic differentiation takes that sense of separation, that light conceptual separation that exists side by side with the wonder and mystery of not knowing, those are not at odds with one another. Those two coexist. And is able to recognize and also navigate within the mystery of life as well. And so there's this beautiful symbiotic relationship that we can grow into without the loss of the meaning and differentiation that life depends upon, but also living in the vastness of wonder at the same time. And it's this point, I think, that we don't quite understand. We sort of want it sort of egoically. We harden that sense of separation into a fictitious sense of me, which then just sets out to keep encouraging a backlog of issues of why I'm so special or so whatever it is that is our descriptive attitude. It can be a positive or negative attitude about ourselves. Doesn't matter as long as we have one. And then we just keep embellishing that attitude, adding layer after layer of experience to confirm our image over time. And then when we hear about separation, we think, oh, you know, I'm not finished yet. I have too much to do. I'm too gross in this way. I don't have enough of that, you know, and I need more of this. And then maybe at some point in the culmination of my individual attainment, I will be able to cross over this conceptual idea of separation. I'm not really sure I believe in non-separation anyway, so it keeps me kind of working towards my advantage to stay in my spiritual journey on this side of equation, on the divided side of the equation. That's one way to proceed, and many of us do so. Many of us want to fix this thing. But listen to the problem. The problem is the conceptualization of separation. And if we're trying to spiritually fix ourselves, you can hear that we are distancing ourselves at the same time we're trying to fix ourselves. In other words, we're enhancing the sense of separation. We're creating more of a problem. We aren't solving the problem. See, that's why the solutions, the Dharma instructions, never have you working yourself towards the resolution. They say, surrender yourself. Surrender your separation. In other words, when you're feeling the tightened tension and anger and disagreement, instead of having to work it out and go back historically to catch all of the incidences when you were a child and who you can blame it on and all of that stuff, at a point in maturity, you can just release the need to be separate. How does that happen? Because surrendering, it feels like, you know, I'm not ready for that. I want to do some more self-work. I want to get this thing so that it looks better than it does and in better shape so that I can shine a little better in my non-separate way. But shining in your non-separate way is really an ego enhancement. And that's why we have to learn some basic things. The first thing we have to learn in order to want to move in terms of non-separation is that we are basically a conditioned mechanism. The sense of I, the way the mind works, is a conditioned machine. It's conditional. We've learned how to be ourselves. And that's one of the real benefits, I think, in therapy or in other expressions of psychology, is that when you go back and you talk about your childhood with somebody and you talk about all the things that happened, you can get a sense that the way you are now had to do with the way you were then. What happened to you then? those, the predicament you now feel you are in, or I am in, came because there were conditions when you were a child that occurred to you that led to this display of your humanity, your temperament, your character. And so you can get a sense, and this is an important point, that what you live within, the character you live within, is conditioned. If you hadn't had that childhood, if you'd had a different childhood, you would be a very different person. Now here's a key point. Therefore, it's not your fault. You see, it's conditions. I mean, really, any of us could live under the certain conditions and we'd be a vastly different person. We would probably be in prison in one set of conditions or whatever. So you get a sense, all right, so what all this is about, this turmoil, this blame, this contentiousness, this anger I have, has been built up systematically through a whole set of conditions and through my image that as a condition arises within me, I begin to own it as my own, and then I begin to move that those conditions forward as the person I am. And so when the conditions come into our obvious enough for us, we bring them into our character and move them forward as a part of who we are. Okay, now this is an important point. What can be conditioned can be extinguished. You don't have to live with that. Whatever you're living with that you don't like, you don't have to live with it. If you don't want to, you don't have to. If you're going to carry your image along with you, you quite likely want to be whoever it is that you are, even though it may not be very pleasant to be who you are. But it's familiar, and familiarity trumps pleasantness. So I'm willing to be the stuffy old blah, blah, blah that other people see me, because that's how people have always seen me. And if you looked backward, you could see how those conditions came to bear to make myself identify in that way. At the same time, we don't have to do that. And this is where the Dharma, I kind of push the Dharma forward, because the Dharma has a straight access road out of your personality, your difficulties, your personal difficulties, if you so wish them to be. It doesn't ask you that if you're this way, that you do the opposite, because then if you do the opposite, you'll have both of those qualities in you, and this quality doesn't like this quality, and you will have growing tension within you, because you'll have the persona and the shadow at odds with one another and in conflict. Right? The person who wants to be open-hearted and the conditioned quality of cruelty or anger that leads to this display, that's going to be a tremendous internal conflict in there. And that can't be resolved except through the tension of me pitting one against the other. It's not very helpful. And so this is where we bring the Dharma forward. But if we lose what Dharma practice is, which is crossing the rift of separation, the perception of separation, it's a perception. It's not the truth. The way we perceive, for the most part, is a mistake. We've mistaken a true perception. How could that be? Well, something comes into your visual field and you have a story about it, because we have a narrative about everything. That story now puts distance between you and the thing that you're perceiving, the place you're going, the person you're meeting, the task you're doing. That distance makes us feel as if we're distant to life, that we're separate from it. that were outside of the living experience. Have you ever felt that way? I certainly have. Where you're just, you're kind of like a passenger in this thing. And that's because we have invested our energy into the narrative of ourself rather than into the experience of life that doesn't have a distance, it doesn't have a duplicity, it doesn't have a separate part. It's all that, that's all arising simultaneously. All life is miraculously present continuously. There's no distance between anything in life. It could never arise in the past tense. How could life arise in the past tense? How could it arise in the future tense? It's always present tense, as the poem says. Living the present tense requires us to release the narrative that keeps us separated, as if life was happening to us, as if we're having to cross this space and distance, which is only formed because of the ideas we have about it. We think the ideas are better than the actual fact. We'd rather live with the idea of life than the actual experience of it. Isn't that amazing? But it's true. Now, why is that? Because we can control the idea, you see. At least it gives us a false sense of control. If I have things that I don't like, I can avoid them. If there are things I do, I can move towards them. And so it gives me a kind of range and power that non-conceptualization doesn't. In non-conceptualization, there's just openness. There's just availability to whatever is arising. And so as soon as I place my options into my visual field, then I've got a narrative running about each and everything I see. And that gives me a sense of empowerment. It's nice to sort of pick and choose who you want to, whatever. But there's a vast, it's so wrong. It's so isolating. You see, it's just, you just feel the deadness of it after a while. Because you're stuck back in here with binoculars, looking through the wrong end of binoculars. And yeah, you can manipulate experiences to a certain degree. You can go left instead of right and forward and all of that. And that makes us feel like we're in charge and in control. But you still remain distant. You remain untouched. Life can't touch you. You can have the pleasant experience of life or the unpleasant experience of life, but that's an experience of life. And to have an experience of life, you have to be the person who tastes it or sees it or feels it or smells it or hears it. And that requires you to be at the table, but not at the feast. And so we don't cross over because why? Man, I've got thoughts. Thoughts are great. I can do anything with thought. I can think about being LeBron James. 5'2", 110 pounds. You can be anybody you want, except you're not. You see, and so what eventually gets our attention about our separate ways is the pain that the creating process generates. Because when we look out and decide what we want from life, we're setting ourselves apart from what life is currently offering. We don't want it to go left, we want it to go right. So I'm gonna get up and move, or I'm gonna do this, or it's too hot in here or something. And so I'm gonna adjust the dials to the reality that I want from life rather than the reality that is actually happening. And as long as I want that, it will seem as if I can get it, but here's the downside. I have to be separate in order to use that strategy. I have to be distant to life in order to impact it the way I intend. So if you love the play of your mind, then separation is going to be your field of joy. And then when you come into a spiritual group, you're going to play that card even within your spiritual journey. Because that will be so central to your life, your need to control, for instance, that you're unwilling to give that up. And to give that up would mean that you are disempowered, and that's unacceptable. So it takes us right into the issues that are where we're most laced with our neediness, with our urgency, with our grasping, you see? And each of us have them. And this journey is meant to take us there. And as we begin to consent to the feelings of the tension that separation brings, we have to remember that the resolution of non-separation is a perceptual shift. That's all. It's not something we have to become in order to make that crossing. In fact, what we have to do to make that crossing is extinguish the conditioning in that moment of our sense of separation, our sense of egoic difference, our sense of egoic separation to life. Instead of feeding it, which means we want more out of that particular disposition, out of that separation, we have to surrender. Surrender doesn't require any energy or any force from you. It doesn't require any muscle. It requires the absence of that. That's how close it is. It's as close as our willingness to release the story of our that is currently in the background there. Release the story, you've released the posture to life. Release the posture, and you've also released the separation. Don't work this in the wrong way. We've just got one chance here, this very brief, short life. Let's know what the point of what we're doing and the ways forward to make this thing happen to our betterment, to our enjoyment, to our fulfillment, not as an egoic separate person, but as at the union that is here already. It's not a lie. Non-separation is the truth. Someday, if you take that in, you'll say, oh, I heard that somewhere before. I said, my God. That guy way back in 2016 who had that crushed Prius. I remember him saying that. So now we've gone from noise making, which is constantly reminding us of what we want from the world, which takes its expression in forms of desire or fear. Desire and fear isn't something that are happening to us. They're something that we're investing in life to keep it at a distance. desiring something keeps me outside of that desired so that I can pursue it. Fear keeps me in the other way, out of harm's way. And so I want to keep thinking so that I'll have my future all planned out for me. I don't want to go that way, that's too fearful. And so we keep investing in these strategies of mind in order to remain as remote as we can and distant. And then we take on desire. You know, this is not the way to do it. You take, okay, I've got to figure out desire. I've got to figure out desire. And at the end of that, you'll know all about desire. I now know all about desire. You haven't crossed any. There's no non-separation. It's just that now you've gained more intellectual understanding of what desire is that's keeping you more distant, but makes you, each of us, feel as if we're somehow moving in alignment to Buddhist thought. What about just releasing it? What about being just quiet for a moment? It doesn't mean you don't take appropriate action. You have a charging bull coming at you, you get out of the way. It doesn't require the mechanics of separation to do that. It requires just discernment, seeing, that's all. See, silence frightens us. Why does silence frighten us? I remember being terrified as a child. I can remember having to go down the dark of night, go down this little pathway to put garbage in the garbage bin at the very end of the yard. And we didn't have any outside lights. And the terror that would grasp me about halfway down. But it wasn't the terror of the night, it was the terror of the silence. What is it about silence that we can't resolve? You see? It's because we can't keep our boundaries in silence. We can't keep our positionality in silence. It doesn't give us a place. Noise gives us a place. When I say you, and I know me, I know my place in relationship to you, I have my history with you, it's all certified. And so as I call out the names in my life through the noise of my thinking, my positionality comes along with it. Silence doesn't allow that placement. And yet, if we can just expose ourselves to it a little bit from time to time, you will grow to the point where you welcome it in. It will feel like a comfort. And you won't miss the edges. You won't miss the boundaries that noise creates. You won't miss the image that you can't maintain in silence. We work stupendously in the quiet, as if we needed the self-reminder of our own containment. And as the noise begins to build in crescendo, we now have problems with the noise that we created. I should be quieter. Or what's the matter with me? Why don't I ever, you see, you'll never win in the field of separation. You can't win because you're pitted against yourself. Whatever you do, the ideal isn't being lived. And when the ideal isn't being lived, you have a job to do, become better. But what if we drop that? You see? Now, some of you, when we, from time to time in these meetings, we'll come to a place where we all drop it together and we feel the resounding quiet that's left. Two things. If this happens to you, notice how pleasurable silence is. Don't let the fear of silence create the next reaction of noise. Sit there for a while. Look around and see if anything is missing. If you miss yourself, if you miss your image, if you miss the noise, you won't. In fact, what will come through the stillness, through the quietude, is a confirmation of that sensing we had long ago. That life is much more unified, much more together than our eyes have ever have betrayed it. And once we get a sense of how to move in that direction, we don't labor over ourselves as some project that needs to be fixed. Because the quietude holds the perfection, not pitting the image against ourselves. Okay. Can we sit for a minute or two? From noise to stillness. Ask yourself from time to time, what does noise give me? What is it offering me that I need? What do my thoughts offer, not individual thoughts, but thinking itself, what does it offer me? What does it do for me? How does it create me? Why do I want it? Because we do. Until we look at the value we get from it. And search that value to see if the payoff is worth the price. And look at the limitation of it. We can sense the limitation. We can sense the isolation, the separation, the distance that it sets us up. We can sense that. We think that's a given. We think separation is a given. Now let's work around the edges of it. But where do we think the spiritual journey is going? If you're going to concede separation, the journey is going to be very frustrating, because the deepest urgency and needs you have are not going to be touched or met. The deepest needs we have are consenting to crossing that division, not sustaining it. Okay. Thank you all for your attention. So if there are any questions or comments, I will do my best to respond. Yes, sir. No, that's not what I meant, but I understand what you're meaning, yeah. So he says that, when you have a problem, he heard me say, just release it. And to him that sounded a little bit like, just get over it, stiff up your lip and just move on. Quit being a mealy mouse or whatever, right? Yeah. No matter what I say wordlessly, we will put words to it. You're going to find words for everything that's wordless. Surrender doesn't hold an attitude. It's that you realize that if you invest more in there, you're not going to get anywhere from further investment, from further argument. You see, the way separation is created is through argument. I have to contest it in order for me to stay alive and active as a player within life. I have to contest it, or I have to grasp it. I have to do something in relationship to life in order to keep a sense of my being there. And that wears us out. That takes a toll on us over time. That tension that's necessary in order to live in separation. I mean, we all feel it. We just think that's what our life is. Now get over it. But it's that very sense of getting over it that isn't taking it seriously. When you really look at the problem, you realize as long as it's going to, there's nothing I can do to life except create its opposition with my thinking. Anywhere I go in contrast to what is actually occurring. Right? The problem is there. I either meet the problem like that, or I meet it like that. If I meet it like that, now I've got a real problem, because I've got stress. And no, it's really a bearing down, difficult problem. If I meet it like this, and I just say, okay, I can't go anywhere. There's only one thing happening here. That's what it is. And what I find is that in that moment of releasing the need to define it with any kind of antagonism, the meeting of it and the resolution of that challenge are really simultaneous. Doesn't mean there aren't challenges, and it doesn't mean that sometimes you don't get the worst end of the deal. It's just that it's just a win. There's nothing, it doesn't take any toll. So it's very quick. You see life, you remember it. You have a prescription for it, and then you set off to work in alignment with that prescription that is an internal process projected out, and that's how I'm going to meet this moment. Okay, all of that kind of configuring, mental configuration, leaves you very isolated and alone. There's no way to, there's nothing you can do. You're just going to have to try to figure your way out, you know, that, and that takes you deeper into the strategies of separation. But what if you just meet it? What if it's just met? What if it's a verb meeting a verb? Did you do that? Yep. That's meeting it. Did you do that? What's he want? If I say yes, then he'll think I'm, but if I say no, maybe. You can get a sense, perhaps, of why meeting life is perceptual. It holds the precepts. It's only when we're like, I need to protect, you know, that kind of, just let it be skewed a little bit. That's where the precepts get muddled. Somebody might find me out. Did you do this? Yeah. You're going to jail. Okay. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
So in meditation, when you are witnessing what is happening in your mind, when you're able to witness, and then you have these blips of insight or realization, I see myself selfing those moments, right? Where maybe desire will come up and I'll go, wait till I tell somebody else what I saw, and then I'm right back into selfing and making it mine. Would you suggest then I just keep stepping back and being aware and witnessing that process happening, and then it's just the process of stepping back? Is that as far as I should know in that position?
No, it's a very good question. His question is about in meditation, when something comes up and he sees it, then there's a sort of a self-gratification of having just seen something, and I'm going to go out and tell people about what I just saw, and all of a sudden you're back into a sense of self-aggrandizing and self-accomplishment and all of that. Don't make too much out of that. That's very common. Everybody goes through that. Okay, so because if you do make too much out of it, that's where the real problem lies. Now you're the super egoic you is on top of all this, and by God, you're gonna punish that person who's. So don't do it that way. Just bear witness to the fact that you just did it. That's all. Okay. Yes, but your use of the word witness, I would use the word witnessing rather than witness. Witness is a kind of a position of you in relationship to what you just saw. And if you look at what the witness contains, it contains an attitude about what it just saw, an opinion. God, I shouldn't have done that. That's not spirit. Whatever. Yeah.
But then that commentary.
Right.
I can see that.
Beautiful.
So it's a stepping back again.
Yes. Okay. But
stepping. Never ending stepping back.
Okay. I wouldn't call it stepping back. Okay. The idea of stepping back is already a movement in relationship to it. Just don't step back. Just be quiet and see. Don't move. You either see it or you don't, and either one is fine. Okay, you can't see more than you see. You see what you see. Okay, so if you say, "Oh, I should see more," now you're back in this whole kind of dynamic. It's like those Chinese finger traps. You know, you go, "Damn, I should see more." No, this is what you do. You put your fingers together and it comes right off. Right? So you go, okay, wow. So I, okay, so that was interesting. Wow, I saw a whole change. You know, you catch it all. Here's what, your intention to see yourself is all that is necessary. Okay? You don't get too, what's the word? Too
vigilant.
Yeah, don't get too, don't be overly vigilant.
Well,
don't be.
Sometimes I feel like I'm creating more divisions because
that's it.
I am the observer observing what is happening.
Okay.
Separating.
See what you can see and don't worry about anything else. Okay? See it? Okay, am I catching the observer observing the observer observer? No. Okay, that's okay. That's fine. It doesn't, it grows by itself. It's like yeast. You know, you got, it's only grown this much, so that's what you can do. So when I was a monk, you know, I was like doing this all the time. And I started seeing that, you know, I just kept creating more concentric rings of views of what's going on, like that. And then I thought, wait a second, what about stillness? And in that moment I suggested that to me, I dropped to stillness and I saw everything. And it had nothing to do with my effort to see. Seeing sees. It becomes limited by your effort at some point. So that's why I don't want you to try too hard to see. Just see what you see, and that's good enough. Have faith that what you see is good enough. No tension in your seeing. If you want to apply aligned practice, okay, relaxed seeing. Is this seeing relaxed? When you take yourself out of the seeing sees more. When your effort around seeing is diminished, you will find you'll see more. Okay.
You said that we are conditioned from our past since childhood. Does that include before childhood, like before, currently, from there, before we came into this life, conditioned from there?
Does our conditioning mean just this life, or does it go way back? This is the wisest thing I'll say tonight. I have no idea. I don't know. I just know that it comes from the past. How far back in there, I don't know. We don't need to know. In fact, I don't really want to know how long I've been around. It's fine to be just, okay, so, but what I can feel is the leanings, right? All the everything that's there, emotions, thoughts, physical, everything is, that's what the 12 steps of dependent origination are conditioned influences on one another that build this crescendo of me. In any particular moment. And so I can get a sense, I don't have to go into every single one of the 12 steps, I can just get a sense that what I'm seeing now and the reason I feel distant from you is that there's some thought that's interfering with my closeness, with our connectedness, right? So if I just let that go, the word distance, the word that distances us is crossed. And that's the only distance there is. There isn't any other distance. There's no such thing as physical distance. It's all word distance. Because the word throws me into the past and has me conjure or contemplate about what to say. Okay, that's not helpful. I would rather not know what to say and say, I don't know, than to try to figure out something clever to say. And I can't do that if I let even a single word interfere with our connection in this moment. And therefore, I surrender the words that do arise, because words still arise, because I see they don't do anything. They hold me hostage. The word holds me hostage, as well as the situation. And I don't want to do that anymore, because I don't think, as an individual, as a culture, as a society, as an engaged earth, we need that. I don't think that's what we need. And that's what I mean when I say, unless we know that part, that inward process of what real engagement is, then we will only offer partial conflict to the engagements that we get involved with prior to that wisdom. So these two things have to move together. Thank you all. Evening.